Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest installment of Shooting the Bull. We appreciate you guys listening. My name is Rhett Rollison. I am the assistant men's tennis coach at the University of South Florida. And joining me, as always, is Bulls head coach, Ashley Fisher. Hello, Ashley. What's up, my man?
Good afternoon, Rhett. I'm doing well.
Yeah, we are truly honored to have Wayne Bryan as our guest today. Wayne is a true legend in the tennis world as a coach, author, and motivational speaker. Wayne is such a great ambassador for the game with his endless enthusiasm. Wayne played for Cal Santa Barbara and is in the Gaucho Hall of Fame. He's in the Southern California Tennis Hall of Fame. He's a three-time World Team Tennis Coach of the Year, and he wrote a great book titled Raising Your Child to Be a Champion in Athletics, Arts, and Academics. And he knows a little something about that as the father of the Bryan brothers, the greatest doubles team of all time. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rhett, and thanks for that nice introduction, and some of that was actually true.
Well, we are really, really honored to have you, Wayne, and I'm going to ask the first question, and then I'll have you and Ash talk a little bit about the book. But out of all your roles and accomplishments, what are you most proud of?
Wow, that's a tough question. Most proud of, I guess simplistic would just be, you know, raising Mike and Bob. I'm also proud to have married my wife, Kathy, who I love dearly, and we've had a great time together. I'm a proud member of my family. I'm proud of my community here. I love the great sport of tennis. I also love music. I love living in the United States, so I've really got a lot to be proud of, and I'm a lucky guy, and I'm definitely a happy guy.
Well, Wayne, we're lucky and we're happy that you've joined us. So thanks again for that. It's great to catch up with you. You know,
That's good to talk to you. It's been too long.
Yeah, it has been. And you know, I have this this sort of challenge when I'm talking about another good friend of ours, Justin Gimelstob, when I try to articulate, you know, his job, and there's just so many different roles that he has, and you remind me of that, you know, just with so many different sort of hats that you've worn over the years. So, you know, if you're sitting on a plane and you know, you have a great energy about you, which I'm sure invites people to talk to you if you're not the first one talking, you know, and the guy in the seat next to you just says, oh, it's nice to meet you, and what do you do? So how would you respond to that?
You know, that's actually interesting because I do a lot of flying, and I always like it when the person next to me is personal and likes to talk too. But what I have always found through the years when I talk to someone, I'm so interested in them. What do you do? How do you do it? What do you think about this? I always try to learn from the other person. And many times when I get off a plane, I realize the person hasn't asked a thing about me. Not that I care, but I've learned a lot about them. But when people say, what do you do? Boy, that's like you say, I've worn a lot of hats. I think I just say I'm in tennis, I'm in music, and I'm in parenting. The blessed thing about my life is I it's so varied. I do a lot of emceeing, of course. I do a lot of coaching, a lot of teaching. I think what I'm really born to do is I'm just one of those guys that I'm a teacher. You know, when I take those psychological tests and you answer 100 random questions, and then when it's all done, they say, here's what you think you are, here's what others think you are, and here's what actually you are. And mine always comes out the same thing. It always comes out, you're a teacher, you're a counselor, you're a motivator, you're that kind of thing. So I really think I'm doing the right thing.
Well, that's good to hear. It's nice when it all matches up like that, and clearly you've picked the right profession there. When you say that, it reminded me. Somebody told me a story about George Bush Senior, who you probably got to see more than I did, just through
actually
him being a lover of tennis and being in Houston.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, great guy, and he knew my college coach Tut Bartson very well. And
yeah,
and somebody said the same thing about George. They somehow they ended up having dinner with him, and they just couldn't get a word in to ask George, because George was so fascinated by this person's life and asking so many questions. And then, you know, George ran into this guy 10 years later, and he just right away, he's like, oh, how's that beautiful wife of yours, Sally, doing? How's the financial industry? He knew everything about this person.
Back in the day before computers, he had the largest personal Rolodex in the world. It said that he had 80,000 people in his personal Rolodex. He knew their family name and the children and the dog and where they went to school, and he kept that. And it's no surprise that he became president of the United States. You're right. He's a great friend of tennis. We did some things with him often when the boys played in Houston. And his son George has also been a supporter of tennis as well. And the boys got to know both of those people pretty well.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, that's one of the great things about tennis is just you get to meet so many amazing people. And I had the chance that during that Houston tournament one year, I went to George and Barbara's house, and I just remember sort of posing as an American. I convinced myself that I'd been educated here, and I was playing doubles with Devin Bowen, and it was, to this day, one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Jeff, one thing on Tut Bart tonight, we were with him one night, and he was speaking to a bunch of juniors somewhere, and it was one of the most fascinating things I've ever heard. He said, you know, back in the war years, I was a junior tennis player, and I used the same three balls for a couple of years, you know, because of the shortages for the war. He said, you know, we wore them out, and pretty soon there was obviously no fuzz. It were just little black balls. So that shows how things were back in the day quite often. You know, you got to appreciate if you can crack open a can of balls that had fuzz on it. You know, I've never forgotten that.
Well, that's certainly the way he ran his program. It was a blue collar, grateful for everything, you know, appreciate what you get. And knowing Tut, you know, he probably only needed one of those three balls. He didn't miss too many shots.
Yeah, he was a fantastic player and a great coach and actually a great guy. I really liked him.
Yeah. So, well, Wayne, what was your childhood like? What drew you to tennis and to music and to your passions? What sort of explain a little bit about the influence your parents had on you and how you've arrived at these, you know, terrific sort of positions in life.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Ashley. It's an interesting question because I was a guy who grew up, I mean, I played all the sports, basketball, football, baseball. I regularly attended church and church functions. I was a Boy Scout, Eagle Scout. I mean, I had to do it all. My parents were always grinding us to do all this stuff. And one night, I was about 10 years old, and my dad came back from work. He was the vice president of Western Airlines. He said, you know, Western Airlines is sponsoring this tournament called the Adler Sox Invitational at the LA Tennis Club. It's a $2,500 tournament. Unbelievable. $2,500 was unbelievable. They had the eight best players in the world, Laver, Emerson, all these great players, Hoed, Gonzalez, all these people. And I said, look, Dad, I play baseball, basketball, football. I don't want to go to some tennis match. He says, my dad was a product of the Depression. He said, look, we got these tickets for free. We're going. Take a shower, dress up. We're going to the LA Tennis Club to see this match. And I said, all right. So my brother and I, we dressed up, went in, and we got right down. They put us in the front row, and right in front of me, warming up with a alpaca beautiful sweater with purple sleeves, and was this Inca god, and he hit a volley right in front of my face, and it went thwack, and it was the most beautiful sound and the most athletic thing I have ever seen. It was a former Wimbledon champion, Alex Almeida. And I have literally been on a tennis court every day of my life since that day at 10 because that just blew me away. That really shaped my philosophy because I really think, you know, you have to see it before you can dream it. And you have to be passionate about it before you can achieve it. I'm a big believer if you want your children to love tennis, you got to go to see tennis at the highest levels. Go see a Davis Cup match. Go see a college match. I'm a big believer juniors should go to see college matches each and every week of the season. It's free. It's exciting. It's raucous. Anyway, to finish that story, I was so inspired watching Alex Almeida play. Fast forward, gosh, about 30 years, maybe 40 years, Mike and Bob and I are doing a big tennis clinic in the islands on Maui. They brought all the island kids in. I guess we had 200 or 300 kids at this beautiful club on Maui. Kathy Nikoloff was putting it on, and we did the clinic and brought the kids back on the center court and did this, that, and the other. And at the end of the day, there was this little 8-year-old boy. He was really good, and as I often do, I said, "Who's the parents of this young man right here? I want to talk to you," you know. And so this mom came down. And in fact, I did that with the Williams sisters when they were 6 and 8 one time at UCLA. It's another whole other story. But anyway, the mom comes down, and I said, "I just want to tell you, this kid is unbelievably talented. He has great passion for tennis, and I think he could play pro tennis. Don't mess him up, you know. Get after him." She said, "Well, I got to tell you, you know, he's just really been inspired by your boys, Mike and Bob." And I said, "Oh, that's very nice. Thank you very much. And, you know, what's your name?" She said, "My name is Amy Omedo." And I go, "Oh, my God, you're not, are you related to Alex Omedo?" She said, "Yeah, that's my dad." And I immediately started crying because, you know, he had inspired me. And now my twin sons were inspiring his grandson. It was a beautiful poetic circle, and it really is central to my philosophy, and that is, you know, you must see it before you can dream it. You don't go out there and start grinding and do the drudgery and say you got to be a tennis champion when the kid's never seen a high school match or a college match or a pro match, to say, "Oh my gosh, I want to do that." And I think any child who sees music at its best or sports at its best, they're going to want to do it. You know, it's how you present it. And so I'm a big believer in watching, because I think champions, again, take it through their eyes and not their ears.
Yeah, well, that's an incredible story, Wayne. And it's my belief, I believe a lot in asking the universe for help and sort of letting the universe know what your goals are and what you're trying to achieve. And then the universe will... There's something called pronoia, which is, it's the opposite of paranoia, that the universe is secretly sort of conspiring to help you, and it will give you clues along the way. And and that's just a great example of just sort of how we're all connected, and just, you know, it's sort of a breadcrumb, you know, you just, an amazing connection there, that how you started is now, it's come full circle.
You reap what you sow. There's just no question. And when you have those early goals, like, you know, Mike and Bob saw a Davis Cup match. They were in the front row for that with Ricky Leach and Jim Pugh, where they were the number one team in the world as young 24-year-olds. And when they saw this match, and it blew their minds. You know, we took them to this Davis Cup match, and we're walking down the tunnel. We went out to get some popcorn, and coming walking right up past us quickly to come into the stadium for the first Davis Cup match was Ricky Leach, who was Peter Pan on the doubles court. We have unbelievable admiration for Ricky Leach and his doubles. I'm sure you saw him play. And Jim Pugh was 6'4", these huge guys. And Mike and Bob were 10 years old, little skinny, tiny guys at the time. And these big come walking by quickly. They had red, white, and blue sweats, USA on the back. And when the boys saw him, they just blurted out, "Ricky!" Because, you know, he was like a huge idol to them. It would be like me seeing Willie Mays or something. But they just went crazy. And Ricky looked back, and bless his heart, he said, you know, he's on his way to his first Davis Cup match. He had to be nervous. He said, "Hey, guys." And he said, "Do you play tennis?" Which was incredibly nice to speak to two little boys in the tunnel when he's so nervous. And they blurted out, "Yes, we just won the Long Beach 10 doubles." You know, and I go, "Oh, my God." I was so embarrassed, and Ricky kept walking. He's just going to the stadium. There's 8,000 people going crazy, walking, and the people are cheering as they walk in. And he looks back, and the light was filtering through him. He was kind of a silhouette. And he looks back, and he pointed his racket at Mike and Bobby. He says, "Yeah, I won that one, too." And all the way home, that just riveted Mike and Bob. They said, "We're going to be the next Davis Cup team for the United States, and we're going to win the Davis Cup, and, you know, blah, 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 because Ricky won the Long Beach 10s, and that's the one we just won." And, you know, they just drew that connection. And, of course, what did I say? You think I would say, "Of course you're going to be the next." I said, "Guys, you're out of your freaking mind. There's 3,500 steps between winning the Long Beach 10s and being the Davis Cup team. You got to be number one in the world to play for the U.S. You got to be number one in college. You got to win the NCAAs. You got to win all kind of titles. You got to win Grand Slams before you can even think about be in the U.S., but no, we're going to do it Long Beach. It was all so simple to them, you know. And so forever, they had tattooed across their forehead, we're going to be the next U.S. Davis Cup team. There was no doubt in their mind. And pretty soon, when they were 11 and 12, they were number one in the U.S., other people started saying the same thing. They're going to be the next great American Davis Cup team. So that little tiny goal that they set when they were 10 became etched right into their face, right into their soul. There was no doubt in their mind that they were going to achieve it. And like you say, because of, you can call it universe, you can call it karma, or you can say they made all kind of choices to achieve that goal. They wouldn't eat a candy bar. They didn't eat sugar cereal. They wouldn't think about drinking a beer. They wouldn't think about missing a tournament. We used to go to this camp every summer. It was a great camp. I used to work there for a week. It was a lot of fun. And they started crying, we don't want to go to the camp. We don't want to miss a tournament this summer. You know, so everything was directed toward achieving the goal. Of course, they had a lot of fun along the path. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't drudgery at all. We had a blast. But because that goal was riveted, and then people later would interview me and they'd say, gee, are you amazed that the boys won the NCAA this day? Are you amazed that they're number one in the world? Are you blown away by the fact that they played the Davis Cup and won the Davis Cup for the United States? And I said, you want a normal answer or you want the truth? They go, we want the truth. I said, I'm not surprised at all because I knew the depth of their goal and how much they wanted it, and what they were willing to do each and every day of their life to achieve it, and each and every weekend on the tournament. So it was no surprise to me whatsoever. That's the power of goal setting. That's the power of seeing things as kids.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And if I'm sort of interpreting it and translating it back, I would say that they knew their destination from a young age. They knew where they wanted to go, and then they got very engrossed in the day-to-day process of it, what they had
Absolutely.
To sacrifice, what they had to do every day. So, you know, it's sort of
and because
like,
it takes so many hours, and you said in an email, so many repetitions, it's crucial that those reps each day are fun, exciting, challenging, competitive, social, and just loaded with fun because you can't wait to get on the court. At no time did they think it was work. No time did they think they made a sacrifice. Never. They never sacrificed once. People always say to me, oh, my God, the Bryan brothers work so hard. I said, I hate to tell you this, but the truth is the Bryan brothers have never worked a day in their life. They love doing this.
Yeah.
You know, they love the way they practice, the drills and games we created. They can't wait to get out there and compete each and every day. And they couldn't wait to see the other kids. They also made it social. The tour to them, they liked the guys on the tour in general. You know, they liked being out there. They liked the fans. They liked everything about it. So, again, it was never drudgery. It was never hard work to them.
Yeah, well, that's amazing, Wayne. And I've just finished reading Nadal's book. I read it a few years ago, but I've gone back and listened to it. And what I was... What really impressed me was just how open Rafa was in terms of just having nerves and having some self-doubt, but understanding that you could distinguish between having the doubts and playing nervously, that you could sort of fight through these tough moments, and it didn't have to. Sometimes he was open about sometimes it did affect him and he succumbed to it. But, you know, he knew that was the battle, that the mind will throw some doubt at you. He had so much respect for Federer that it was difficult for him to play him on grass or other surfaces. But, you know, he just saw that as this internal battle against himself as well as Roger.
Well, there's no question that that's the whole ballgame. And the thing I would say to you, and you're a coach, you know, I think you've got to create pressure in practice. Yeah. With everything right, you lose this 11-point contest, you're going to go down a court. If you win it, you're going to go up a court. You know, you always – I don't think Mike and Bob have ever sort of hit a ball without something on it, you know, because I definitely believe you got to compete in practice. And then at the end of the day, the Biggest Losers got to run up to the top of the mountain. We call it Mount Vesuvius near our club. And you had to come up back in 4 minutes or you got to run it again, you know. And that was, and the guys that win, they got an oatmeal raisin cookie or a Gatorade or a new wristband or a hat or a t-shirt. You know, good things happen to the ones that won and bad things happen to the ones that lose. I think you've got to get next to winning and losing every day. And
yeah.
every because too many people try to avoid losing. You know, you got to get next to it, and you got to know that. God, dog, I hate that, and I love this. But you got to have a lot of reps at losing and a lot of reps at winning. That's the only way. I remember when the boys played in the finals of Davis Cup in 2005 against Spain. There was a young player by the name of Rafael Nadal who beat Roddick. We were shocked. He was, I think Nadal was like 17 or 18. So I couldn't believe it. Andy lost to him. And there was 26,600 people in the stands. It was the biggest Davis Cup crowd since White City back in the day in Australia. I think that was in 56 or 54, whenever it was. And I said, my God, guys, how could you even swing your racket or move your arm in front of 26,600 screaming maniac Spanish fans who were going crazy on every point? It was like a soccer crowd. I said, how could you do that? And he said, oh, that was nothing compared to being in Georgia, playing, you know, the NCAAs.
Yeah.
People eating us alive, swearing at us, calling us every name in the book, and pouring beer on us on the change. You know, they said, the
yeah.
Spaniards, they never poured any beer on us. They didn't swear at us. At least we couldn't tell because we couldn't understand what they're saying. He said, that was nothing. And then when they were at Georgia, they said, oh, that was nothing compared to the drills you used to put us through. You know, I'd have a thing
right.
called a money ball. And you got to make this shot, and they could, the kids could throw balls at you, throw water balloons at you. You know, I made it very difficult in practice on big situations with big consequences.
Yep.
And, of course, then they competed every weekend in a tournament. So pretty soon, that's just what you do, you know. Is that exactly like a Wimbledon final match point? Maybe, maybe not. But it's the same syndrome. It's the same shtick. You got to stay loose.
Yeah.
You got to keep moving. You got to breathe. You got to be happy. You got to hit the ball with enthusiasm and energy to the best of your ability. And I think if you look at Mike and Bob's career, pretty much they played in a very narrow band of their ability. They didn't, you know, they really didn't get that. Could they win or lose? Of course, they can win or lose at any time. Anybody could beat them. And we have respect for everybody on the tour. They can lose any time, but they're going to compete at their best pretty much every time because they were brought up to face winning and losing and competing every single day. They just didn't hit balls. They competed.
I'm so glad you said that, Wayne. I'm going to have our guys listen to that because that's a big theme of our program. And we do drills like that where there is some sort of consequence where we are trying to simulate pressure and make your arm feel tight. And you know, yesterday we were doing a drill where and it was just guys had to hit 7 balls over the service line, and they weren't particularly difficult feeds. But if they miss, then they have to run a suicide. And guys had already done fitness that day, and you know the other guys are watching. And it's amazing just the difference. You just as soon as you put those conditions on it, it's not easy. And the guys start, you know, when they get closer to 7, their arm feels tighter. But I said, be grateful. You know, like when you play that deciding match, this is how it's going to feel. And the more
yeah,
you get
you
comfortable in that place of discomfort, the better off you are.
And the guys are probably enjoying it. And hopefully they're ragging each other and kidding each other and yelling at each other and, you know, duplicating that collegiate pressure. It's like in basketball. A lot of guys can go out and hit 95 out of 100 free throws. But the best way to do it is shoot two free throws and run up and down the court 5 times and then come back and shoot 2 more and then run up and with all kind of stuff. And if you miss it, then you run up and down the stairs. I mean, you make it a realistic situation rather than just endlessly hitting the same shot. Or, you know, you want to create pressure and realism in your practices. If you can do that, then you're there. And the same
yeah.
with playing singles and doubles every day. I believe you play. I like short duration matches, like maybe a 15-minute match. You line up the 8 guys. Whoever wins comes up a court. You go. You lose, you go down a court, and you play 6 or 8 short matches. And at the end of the day, who's ever on the top of the court, you say, this is the best player we got today. And that guy down
right.
at the end, he's the worst player we got today. he's got to do this, and this guy gets that, you know? And then you do that every day, and it's going to tell you a lot.
Yeah. Well, and you need the losses. The losses are a guidance system. They give you feedback. They show you what you need to work on. You know, it's you've got to learn how to – you know, well, the better you get, the more you lose. I mean, if I had a year where I won half my matches, that was a great year for me. So, you know, that's just trying to impart that on the guys that, hey, you don't want to be winning. I mean, it's great if you won 10 matches in a row, but if that becomes the norm, then, you know, something's probably off. You know, maybe we're not getting you strong enough competition, or you're not, unless you're the best player in the world, you know, you're not getting exposed. You need to get exposed to figure out. And Roger and Rafa will say this, that they don't look at each other as, oh, I would have won more slams. They look at each other as, you made me so much better. You made, you know, for Roger, he had to adapt and get his backhand better. You know, for Rafa to beat Roger, he had to come up closer to the baseline and not play quite as passive and quite as deep. And so it's and we're just so lucky to have this sort of access from guys.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like we had 85 juniors in our program. We had 17 courts. We had a lot of really great national caliber juniors and D1 college players and some pro players. But I would give a lecture at the end of the world, a little chalk talk in front of the fireplace, a fire chat for 15 minutes after each workout. And one day I had all these top juniors. I said, this is the biggest loser in the history of our club. And they'd all laugh and point to different people in the room, this guy, that guy. And I said, no, the biggest losers in the history of our club, without a doubt, the guys that have lost the most matches here in our history, is Mike and Bob Bryan.
Yeah.
They've also won the most, but they also – you know how many Mike matches Mike and Bob lost on the tour? I haven't looked at it, but I think it's like 360 matches. 360
yep.
matches. Every one of them was painful as hell. Some were three-setters, some were close, some were – but that was painful. But they also won more than any team in history. So you can see the importance of losing and how you deal with it. Let me just say one thing, if there's any parents listening. I'm a big believer if the child loses, that child's in pain right then. I mean, most – if he's a competitor at all, if he or she is a competitor, when they lose, they're in pain. I don't care the score. I don't care the circumstance. It's painful to lose. It's painful to lose at darts or croquet or at a test or an audition or gymnastics. It's painful. And that's when you don't come out and start teaching them, because they can't hear it. They're hurting. Your best thing, I always tell parents, you got three things you can say. You want a water or a Gatorade. You want some Chinese food, Mexican food, or Italian food. The third question is, you want to drive or you want me to drive? If the kid is under 16, you only got two questions. What do you want to drink? What do you want to eat? You don't pull out the yellow legal pad, and you don't say at 5-all in the third, you had a backhand pass, you went down the line, you should have gone cross court. You know, that's a bunch of crap. First of all, the parent can't play. The kid had 0.3 seconds to make the decision, and who knows if it should have gone down the line across court. Who knows? You know, and the kid's out there
right.
battling. He came up short that day. So what you do on Monday when you're in the workout, you create a backhand passing shot drill. And you create a fun deal. You don't look back and say, oh, my God, you'd have won the match if you'd have hit that backhand pass. You know, you create, you make your observations, and hopefully the observations are good. They need more work on the kicker out in the ad court. They need to stick that high volley more. They don't have enough variety. They can't change direction of the ball on the floor. Whatever it happens to be, create a drill or game that is fun and competitive and bring out what you need to bring out. Maybe there's a technical thing. So keep your head with the ball. Don't pull out too soon. Little extra steps to set up a little better. Keep your racket head relaxed and light. Whatever it is, you can throw out a couple things, but create a drill in the game and a competition that'll bring out what you want. But don't critique with a yellow legal pad any more than you want me to go to your office and critique your performance at the job that day.
Right. Yeah. You talk about it in the book about being unconditional. It's, you know,
absolutely.
I've heard it from other sort of experts in the field of when you pick up your son from soccer you know, the first question can't be, you know, what was the score? It's, you know, you may not even talk about soccer, or the first question could be, you know, did you have fun out there? Were you a good teammate? Just prioritizing
right.
these things that are within the
tell
child's
me about
control.
The game, you know? Exactly. Yeah. You make it a positive situation. They don't want to be critiqued. They're on the side of the curb. They're bleeding. They're dying. They're hurting. You got to pat them on the back. I remember one time Mike and Bob were in the finals of San Antonio 14s. They had won all the nationals that year. They were playing a team they had beaten pretty easy the week before. Keith Brill and Porter Jones. There was a big crowd out to see the Bryan brothers and the 14s and media and all kind of people we knew. And they went out and they got the hell stomped out of them, 1-2. Now I can say, and so we went under it was an old WTA constructed stadium, and it was really dark and dank down the locker room. It was almost black. And I went in, and then there's these little twin boys that are 14, they're skinny little guys, and they're both just crying, standing there just weeping. And I came up and got in the middle and put my arm around them, and, you know, I started crying myself. I said, guys, let me tell you about a time I was in a final against Kenny Stewart, you know, in a pro tournament in Glenmont. You know, I wanted to get out there and win. A lot of people came out to see me. And Ken Stewart kicked my ass 0-0. I couldn't even win a point. He just killed me. I was so embarrassed. You guys got out there today. You beat him a couple weeks ago. But they just played too good today. You guys gave it a great effort, 1-2. I can't wait for the next match. In other words, I gave him some perspective. I, you know, humbled myself as well. Gave him some support, you know, put my arm around him, cried with him. And then they always know they can trust me when they lose or when it's not going their way. Anybody can be the happy parent when they win. I say tone it down a little bit when they win, and your work begins when they lose. You got to be sort of positive and upbeat. And let's say your child's out there in a gymnastics match or a swim meet or a golf tournament or a tennis tournament, and they don't hit a ball. You got to sit there and say, man, you look good in that outfit today. And you remember that one forehand winner you hit in the second set at four? Man, that was a great four. Find something,
yeah,
hopefully a lot of things, that they did well that day. I just had a little girl's one. I'm working well. I saw her play last weekend. Lost one match 11-1 and won another match 2-2. And I thought, you know, the great thing about that is both the matches, you played great. You serve well. You cracked the forehand. You cracked the back. You were moving the feet. And you know, you got killed because the person was just too good. You know, you won because what's good, but you played well in both. I'm so happy with your progress. So we had a great session out there today. Hey, we're going to work on, let's get this a little bit, let's get that a little better. But positive after losses. Give them love. If you see a child, when a parent comes up to them and the child leans away and winces as the parent approaches, you know that parent don't know what they're doing. If the child goes up to the parent after the match, win, lose, or draw, you know they have a good relationship. Shut up when they lose. Support the child. And when they win, it don't matter what you do because everybody's so happy. I say tone it down a little bit when they win because you should never have your child equating winning with more love or winning with a happy parent. You know, you want to be the same all the time. You know, you want to be happy all the time, hopefully, and positive all the time, win or lose.
I had a good story that I'll add to that, Wayne. This past weekend, my son, who's a 15-year-old left-handed pitcher, they're playing a national travel tournament. And, of course, I took the one weekend off so mom could go spend some time with him and I could spend some time with my other son because I tend to be the parent that always goes and travels with my younger son for baseball. And he gave up his first home run, and which is – that's part of life, you know, on the big field. He gave up his first home run on the big field. And after the game, you know, my simple text to him is – and I'm not saying that I've been the perfect father. I mean, a lot of stuff you're saying is hits home with me as a competitive father, as we all were, as an athlete. And my simple words to him was, keep your head up. And so I get a call from my wife. And she said, Rhett, you know, those simple words meant so much to him because he was so concerned, not really concerned, but, you know, he was so frustrated that he gave up a home run. And it wasn't a game-ending losing home run or anything. It was just giving up his first home run. And she said, just the fact that you said keep your head up meant the world to him. And that just reiterates everything you just said. And I think, you know, whether it's tennis, whether it's baseball, whether it's basketball, you see that so much of the attention and the treatment is conditional based on the performance. And I think the words you just said were golden.
Right, and you must know that there's going to be some real bad mistakes, you know. It might be more than a home run. Maybe he gives up four home runs in a row, or maybe doubles faults on match point, or falls off the thing in the gymnastics meet, or he misses a one-foot putt. I mean, that's when the parent has to be, you know. I mean, I wrote the most creative emails and the best calls ever when Mike and Bob maybe lose a Wimbledon final. Because, you know, when they win Wimbledon or win the French or Australian, I mean, I get 3,500 texts, 7,000 emails, so many calls, my phone is shaking. And so do they. But, you know, the funny thing is when they lose a Grand Slam final or some big match, nobody calls because people don't know what to do. You know, that's first. They're not being mean. They just don't know what to say. But, you know, the biggest people in the world contact you when they lose, when you lose. People like Phil Jackson of the Lakers talks to the boys when they lose, or Vic Braden or Barry McKay or Jack Lane. People that know the deal. Ricky Leach, one time the boys lost Wimbledon, Ricky said, you know, guys, I lost my first Wimbledon. I was up 4-2 in the fourth, up a break. And it turned around, I lost it, but I came back and won it the next year. And that's what you guys are going to do. And they did that. So the greatest coaches I know, the greatest parents I know, the greatest mentors I know are great when the kids stumble and fail badly. You know, I mean, really, you know, come up massively short. That's when you're challenged. It's not when they win. I think the best coaching comes after a win, but the best life lessons and character comes after a loss. And that's when most parents, they do all their coaching after losing, and they don't say anything after, you know, they don't take the child forward. But what you're saying is, and you got to get really creative with those texts and calls. I mean, I've had to make 360 of those, and I'm in massive pain if Mike and Bob lose a Grand Slam final, or if they lose in the finals in Memphis or San Jose or LA or anywhere, an exhibition, I'm upset. But I never show it. I keep it in, and I do my best to help them when they're crying and bleeding. I do my best to help them. I get creative. I get positive. Whatever I can come up with. I write my very best notes and my very best calls to them when they lose. And you know what happens to me after doing that? My pain, my personal, is greatly reduced because I guarantee you I feel as bad as they do. In fact, I probably feel worse. You know, I remember when the boys lost a Wimbledon final, my wife went in her bedroom and cried for 3 days and never came out. I went into my bedroom and cried for a day without coming out. I didn't eat. I was just so upset. And the boys said they were in a hotel room for a week and didn't come out. You know, so it's painful, especially for champions. Champions hate losing more than normal people, but they can deal with it and they can take the loss and they get next to it. But those are some words I would give to parents and coaches. You're challenged when your child loses, not when they win.
That's some great stuff, Wayne. I've just watched, there's a great Netflix special called The Coach's Playbook, and you'd actually be a great candidate for one of these episodes, Wayne. And Patrick Mouratoglou is one of the coaches that's featured, and he talks about early in his career, I can't remember the player he was working with, but she was having a tough time competing, and she was, you know, not giving her best effort in some matches and, you know, what we would probably call tanking. And, you know, he thought hard about how to handle it. And he went up to her and she was expecting a tongue lashing. She was expecting him to really get stuck into her, and he actually took responsibility for it. He said, you know, this one is on me. I'm sorry. I didn't prepare you well enough. And he said he saw this look in her eyes, and from that day on, it never surfaced again. She never had competing issues because she knew he was there for her.
I can't agree with that more. There was a famous coach named Jim Verdick at Redlands. He had two sons, Randy and Doug Verdick, good friends of mine. I think he won more college matches than anybody in the NAIA. One time, his Redlands team lost 9-0. And all the guys in the car, oh, man. He was a former football coach. He said, he's going to kill us today. And he got in the car and said, damn it, guys, I let you down today. And that's never going to happen again. It was my fault. And that's the way I always felt in World Team Tennis. When we lost, I looked at the ceiling all night. It was on me. I had a girl who played for me for 13 seasons who should remain nameless. She was a top, I think she was 4 in the world in doubles, 60 in the world in singles. Hell of a player from Russia. And when she was loose and rolling, she's a hell of a player. When she was tight, wasn't worth a damn. She couldn't move. She couldn't swing the racket, blah, blah, blah. And it took me 3 years to figure it out, but I don't want to work out with this girl in Paris. I hate that girl. One of the girls, I said, you want to get better? You play this girl in practice every day. We're going to compete. And we went out there and competed. We worked through it. And I doctor a point every time she expressed any negativity. I went through all these things and rituals, and we worked it out. But I bought her dinner each night, put my arm around her, said, I'm behind you 100%. You want to get better? This is what you got to do. But I'm with you, and it's going to be on me. You trust me, and we're going to figure this out together. I said, and I had her stand up and fall back straight into my arms about 10 times to make sure she trusted me. And the more that the player trusts you, the better job you can do for them. I think it's Eddie Robinson, the great coach at Grambling. He said, coaching is a profession of love. And I think that really is the key.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, it's all about service, and I think it's easy to get wrapped up in your own emotions and make it about you. But it's if we can be guided by what's best. What does this athlete need to hear right now? It's the same as being a doubles partner. I think you've got to, whatever frustration you have, you have to suppress it and just ask yourself, what does my partner need to hear to prepare him or herself to play the next point as well as possible? And
exactly.
Just constantly
we see a lot of teams
that.
Breaking up on the tour, Ashley, right?
Right.
Teams break up because they can't do that very thing.
Yeah.
That's a whole other discussion, the relationship of two partners. I think that is crucial. It's not only your game should complement, but your personality and your character has to complement as well.
Yeah, well, Wayne, this has been amazing. Just like when we speak to Justin Gimelstob, we say we need more time. And if we're ever fortunate enough to have you back, we're gonna make sure we book more than 45 minutes. But this has been such a thrill. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed reading your book and your syllabus and reading your emails and reconnecting with you. And you've inspired me, Wayne, in the last couple of weeks. You've made me a better coach. And this is just gold.
Nice.
I'm going to listen to this over and over again. So thank you so much. Please say hi to Kathy and stay safe during these times.
Well, I really respect your playing career, Ashley, and I'm so glad that you're a college coach now, and I'm so glad you do a podcast to help our sport and the players that played and the coaches. And you're a credit to the game. You're a longtime friend. It's good to say hello to Red as well. And stay in touch and wishing you and your family all the best always.
Thank you, Wayne. All the best.
Thanks a lot, Red. Thank you, Ashley. Bye-bye.
Such an amazing honor, Ashley. There's just so much meat on the bone to chew from there, and I wish we had time to do it, but we don't. And, just so many great life lessons that I'm going to share with every athletic parent that is in my circle. And, I heard some things that I needed to hear. So again, it was an honor, and and unfortunately we didn't have more time with Wayne, just an amazing guy. So for head coach Ashley Fisher, this is Rhett Rollison, and thank you for joining us for the latest installment of Shooting the Bull, and we'll see you down the line.